record reflect the Senate In-State Energy Committee was convened at 7:30 a.m. February 5th, 2013. The following Senate members are present. Senators Coghill, Senator Michicki, Senator Egan, Senator Wilikowski, and let the record reflect Senator Giesel is in attendance today. Good morning, everybody. And myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to recognize the staff today, Christopher Dickrell, Senate Records, our LIO moderator, Heather Parker, my committee staff, Pete Feldman, and everybody knows the cell phone drill, so I don't need to reemphasize that. I would encourage people to ask questions as we go through the presentation today. Today we have, I'd like to welcome Frank Richards to our Alaska, from the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. I've asked Frank to come to the committee and present an overview of the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. We also have Darrell Kleplin, the commercial manager, Dan Fowski, CEO for the project. I believe Dave Haugen is also online. To answer questions, I'd like to invite Frank to come forward at this time and state your name for the record, and please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards, Pipeline Engineering and Government Affairs Manager for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Before I get going, I would like to offer Dan Fowski an opportunity if he has a brief intro.
Go ahead, Dan. State your name for the record and do your intro.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you. I'm here with Darrell Kleppen. Dave Haugen is not in attendance or traveling, doing interviews with firms that we've been interviewing to select on some of our engineering work. So I send his apologies. I'm anxious for Frank to get into the presentation. Darrell and I are here to answer any questions. We really appreciate the opportunity. And I think this optimized plan that we're presenting has certainly got a lot of people's attention and has answered a lot of folks' questions. So with that, I'll sign off, Mr. Chairman, and be here available for questions.
Okay. Anybody have any questions for Dan while he's right here ready to go? All right. Frank, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I start, I'd like to just start and state who we are and what the project is that we've been advancing over the last 2.5 years with the inception of the project, or the handoff to us, which was essentially provided under House Bill 369, which mandated that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation facilitate the design for an in-state pipeline. AHFC then created a subsidiary called the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to take over the project planning and execution. And the project is known as the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. That's our in-state project, which was the mandate provided to us by the legislature, which was to provide for in-state needs for interior Alaska and users within the Cook Inlet Basin at the lowest possible cost at the earliest possible time. So that's the charge that we've taken over the last couple of years. We appreciate, again, the support of the legislature over the last couple of years, as well as with the governor and his recent statements in the state of the state, identifying a boost to our project, which would help us move the project forward to get energy to Alaska. We have been working diligently over the last couple of years. As I said, we've acquired 604 miles of state right-of-way from the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. That includes the Fairbanks Lateral. We've also completed a final environmental impact statement in November of 2012 and are waiting patiently for a record decision to come from the Bureau of Land Management, which will be their decision on their action, which will ultimately be another 100 miles of federal right-of-way granting to the project, giving us a total of 704 miles out of 770 miles of pipeline. That leaves us then with less than 10% of the mileage to acquire from private lands, as well as with Native Corporation lands. The AGDC team has recently optimized the project plan from the original scope, and by that I mean we changed the composition of the in-stream gas from an enriched natural gas stream to a lean natural gas stream. With that, we pulled out the natural gas liquids that we had used. The primary plan was to use those natural gas liquids as a benefit to lower the cost, because at the time, at the initiation of the project, natural gas liquids were selling at a premium to oil. So that is now, that has been reversed with the conditions down south, and we're seeing that the NGLs are not as cost beneficial as they were. We were advancing the pipeline engineering, but most recently, as Dan said, we are talking now with a facilities design group. This is the kickoff meeting today, and that's where Dave Haugen is in Long Beach, working with Fluor Worley Parsons to do the facilities design for the gas treatment plant and compressor station. And then we've also been working with the sponsors and the legislature on enabling legislation that we will need to be able to move forward to meet the timelines that were provided to us by the legislature. And then we're also then planning an aggressive summer field program to be able to acquire the necessary geotechnical hydrologic information to be able to permit the project and advance it forward.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the plan to do with the liquids that you strip out?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, those liquids will remain on the North Slope for the producer's use. They'll use them, I'm assuming, as municipal injectant to enhance oil recovery.
Who do they belong to? They belong to the state? They belong to the oil companies? Do we pay for them and then give them back, or how does it work?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'll ask our commercial manager, Daryl Kleppen, to answer that. He's been in negotiations with the producers.
Daryl, this is, did you hear the question?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I did. This is Daryl Kleppen, commercial manager for AGDC. Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, the current plan for the AGDC project is to take gas straight from the central gas facility on the slope and into our treatment plant, so we do not take the natural gas liquid stream. And the ownership of the natural gas liquid stream is owned by the producers and, of course, the royalty share of the state.
Senator Marchicki.
Yeah, just to follow up there. So if someone put together a distribution system for NGLs, you will be processing and certainly leaves open a business model for someone that wanted to distribute throughout the state by truck. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Marchicki, those natural gas liquids would remain on the slope. They would not be injected into our pipeline. And a number of those components are currently used for miscible injecting in EOR processes. But potentially down the road, this could be available for other users.
Thank you.
Frank, I'd just like to roll back. Did you have a follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Well, it's a slightly different area, so
I'd like to roll back just for a second on 10% of the land negotiations is still in either private hands or native corporations, correct?
That's correct.
Or do you have off the top of your head what corporations you'd be dealing with?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have those right off the top of my head.
Okay, if you can just do a follow-up, that'd be great.
Will do.
And Senator?
Yeah, he had a different question.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. So what's the cost for the gas that we're looking at, and what is the gas currently selling for between the producers on the North Slope?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, our model is we're to pay $2 for the gas on the North Slope, and I believe Daryl will be able to answer what they're currently paying. Daryl?
Hello, this is Daryl Kleppen, commercial manager for AGDC. Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski. Currently, AGDC, as a pipeline owner, is not a shipper in the pipeline. So in terms of the cost of gas, that would be determined by the purchasers and shippers of the gas. For modeling purposes, we assume nominally the netback of the gas on the North Slope would be $2, and we also assumed a distribution charge at the other end of $2, just to give a all-in with those course assumptions. Yeah. Current pricing on the slope, I'm not aware of individual contracts. State royalty gas is probably closer to $4, $3.50 to $4, I would guess. I haven't looked at it in the last month or so.
And what makes you think you can get it for $2 when it's currently selling for $4?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, again, we would not be the purchasers of the gas, AGDC, currently. The shipper, whoever that might be, would be responsible for acquiring and shipping their gas. Historically, large volumes have been purchased at somewhat of a discount, but that is to be determined in the future.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Do you foresee a postage stamp tariff, or will it vary depending on offtake point?
Go ahead. This is Darrell Kleppen again, AGDC Commercial Manager. Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I believe, asked the question.
Correct.
Currently, we have distance-sensitive rates in our model. So, for example, in our model, the people in Fairbanks would only pay for the costs up to that point of offtake. And similarly, at Fairbanks or anyone in between, it would be a distance-sensitive tariff, not a postage stamp tariff.
Do you have some idea of the tariff at this point, or have you not gotten that far?
Yes. I believe Frank, I'm not sure of which slide pack you're using, Frank, but I believe there is a slide in there that shows the tariffs for Fairbanks and Big Lake.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we will get to the tariff model and the input parameters.
Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I have on the slide in front of you was the a plan that was developed by AGDC as required by HB 369. In July of 2011, we were to present a plan for advancing the project. And in this, it was based, as I said, on an enriched gas stream, which required gas conditioning, fractionization, and a straddle plant necessary to move the gas or to strip out the natural gas liquids at Dunbar and then be able to ship utility-grade gas into Fairbanks, along with a fractionation plant at Point McKenzie. All of those were very expensive facilities, and with the change to the lean gas case, we were able to modify the design, remove facilities, and change the pressure and the diameter on the pipe. So in the original plan, it was a 24-inch, 2,500 PSI pipe shipping enriched gas. Our optimized plan is changing again to a 36-inch diameter pipe, lowering the pressure to industry standard 1480, going with the same 12-inch diameter pipe into Fairbanks, but again removing those costly facilities and reducing the overall cost and impacting positively then, as we'll get into, the tariffs specifically for Fairbanks and Anchorage.
Frank, I have a question. I don't know if you can answer it or if Dave's online, but that's maximum working pressure for that's 500 wall pipe. This 36 inch.
That's Mr. Chairman. That's correct. It's maximum allowable operating pressure of 1480.
At a half a B, going through the line full.
You're correct,
full
Mr.
on.
Chairman. Again, the design concept that we have advanced is in compliance with the GEA. The GEA statute required that any state-sponsored in-state gas pipeline only design up to 500 million cubic feet a day, and that's the process that we have followed.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Why go from a 24 to a 36-inch pipe with the optimized plan? Isn't the larger pipe much more expensive?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, when we were able to do away with the compression, the compressor stations, the intermediate compressor stations on the 24-inch pipe, we were able to then increase the size of the pipe, which meant that we were able to go with a ANSI 600-pound class as opposed to an ANSI 1,500-pound class pipe, which meant that we were going with more common steel. We weren't having to go for the X65 or X70 grade pipe. Also with those, the appurtenances, the mainline block valves, the flanges, all the other parts that were going into that would have to be at that same grade steel, which are very expensive, not common products that could have been built, but they would have been built at a premium cost. So we're looking again at the mandate to reduce the cost overall for the delivery of the gas.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Dan.
Dan Faske, if I may ask a favor. Frank, could you please speak louder into the mic? We're having a very hard time hearing you on this, Dan.
Okay, Dan, we'll do.
Thank you very much.
So just to put it in layman's terms for me, you reduce, by getting rid of the compression, you're saving a lot of money, enables you to go to a larger pipe, which you save money because you don't have to use as, I guess, sophisticated or costly design. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, again, it's always a trade-off between compression and pipe diameter. So with the removal of the intermediate compressor stations, we were able to go with one compressor station or head station on the That one head station is the only compressor station that we have for this project to flow the 500 million cubic feet a day. That compressor station with that volume of pipe at the 36-inch allows us to flow up to the 500 million from Prudhoe Bay to Cook Inlet.
Senator Wilkowski, if I could just add something, maybe helped. That bigger diameter pipe, wall thickness, you're saving a lot. It's weight, and it's steel. And I'm not going to get ahead of these guys, but I do know a little something about the industry. I'm curious to see the welding procedure, because I think the welding procedure is going to be a lot easier to get on this project than it would be on your 24-inch line with your exotic steels.
Mr. Chairman, again, the trade-off is going to be in terms of the grade of the steel, too. And with a larger diameter pipe, you're going to have more weld metal associated with that pipe. But again, it's going to be an easier process to construct.
You're not capping and filling a 1-inch. You're capping and filling a 1/2-inch.
That's one more question, Mr. Chair. If you were to increase compression, if you were to add compression later down the road, would this pipeline be able to handle? What would be the maximum capacity throughput this pipeline would be able to handle?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, again, we are limited in our design to the 500 million. Certainly, conceptually, if you add compression, you will have more flow. We were asked this question yesterday in House Resources, and I believe that we now have maybe Ledge Legal and possibly the AG's office looking at whether or not we could actually then calculate that, because we don't want to place ourselves in jeopardy with the AGIA statute.
Okay. So you can, I mean, you're not designing a pipeline that can carry more than 500 million cubic feet, which is the intent of the AGIA statute. I mean, I'm just asking, if you were to, could you theoretically add compression later on and pump through a billion and a half cubic feet? With the pipe, with the strength of the pipe that you're currently using?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, you can add compression, yes, and get more flow. The actual, if I heard your question correctly, you're actually looking for the ultimate flow on that pipe. And that's where we're looking to see that we don't want to place ourselves in jeopardy.
Thank you. All right, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Dan?
Dan Foskick, I'm going to try and help here if I may, and if I totally botched this, it wasn't because I had evil intent. I want to remind everyone, I was at the hearing yesterday when the council advised us, but I think Senator Wilkowski makes a good point. We're designing to a certain dimension that stays within the parameters. However, I know at the gas caucus we were asked the same question, and so I'm just going to go ahead and state that at that caucus we went ahead and said, if asked to, or if in answering that question, this pipe could carry up to 1.6 billion feet of gas a day. And I don't think I violated anything there, because Senator Wilkowski is correct. We're not designing that pipe, but it's a hypothetical question that I think for the purposes of the committee could help you folks better understand what it is, what potential there is.
Thank you, Dan. Senator Michicki has a question.
And I just wanted to point out that many pipeline projects are designed at a lower pressure, and the economics later allow that system to be expanded for a much higher capacity. So there's nothing unusual about that design.
Thanks for the comment, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, as I said, the optimized plan that we released in late 2012 has many positive aspects to it. Again, the reduction in the number of facilities means that it has less a significant footprint on the environmental impacts. It means that we'll have less risk in the project due to the grade of the pipe and the appurtenances that we will have. It means less costly connections to any Alaskans or Alaskan industry along the line that would like to be able to tap into the pipe. It would mean that we would not be required a straddle plant to be able to push gas into Fairbanks. And the risk, the design risk, the construction risk, the finance risk has been reduced significantly because we're using industry standard. All of this, when I get to the tariff model, you'll see that we've been able to lower the tariff. Our construction costs overall are still estimating to be about $7.7 billion in 2012 dollars, plus or minus 30% based on the level of engineering where we currently are. This relates to approximately $7.5 billion that we had identified in 2011. But when you factor in the cost of inflation in that project, it was almost an equal amount at $7.7 billion for either of the projects. We're using a 2.5% inflation factor, which equates then almost $200 million a year in additional costs for every year that the project is not advanced. And we felt that we are not in competition with AGEA. So that's where we are continuing to stay within the constructs of the law.
Thank you.
Could I point out just
Senator Merticki?
Just and NGLs are important to Alaskans. Clearly, the priority here is natural gas to Alaskans, hopefully with some left over for export. But I think Alaskans should know that should NGLs become valuable later, they could be processed in the same pipeline as appropriate for shipping NGLs as well if they're introduced in the stream in the future. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Merticki, if there is a market for NGLs, then it'll be depending on the phase of the NGL. So if we had to keep the NGL in the gaseous phase, then we would possibly require a higher strength pipe. That was the original concept for the 2,500 PSI pipe, to be able to keep those NGLs in the dense phase to be able to transport them. For the 1480, we've designed it for the lean gas without NGLs. Mr. Chairman, the approach that we've taken on this project is called a stage gate approach. The chart that you see in front of you, we've been presented to the legislature over the last couple of years. It's a front-end loading approach where there are specific stage gates. The 2011 project plan was the end of what is known as FEL 1 or front-end loading 1. And at that point, we were to enter into FEL 2, which was going to be the alternate selection stage, the advancement of the preliminary engineering. We have been waiting for the action on the legislature to be able to give us enabling legislation as well as funding to advance the project. So that's what you'll hear from me later on, is what we need to be able to push this project through to the next stage gate, which would be the open season and then ultimately project sanction at the end of FEL 3. After FEL 3 comes the execution or construction phase of the project.
Frank, I got a question. So for our benefit and people that are listening and going forward, more detailed design and project information is where you're out from getting that information.
Mr. Chairman, if we are granted the funding necessary, we will advance both the pipeline, facility engineering, and more of our regulatory action. We have here to date focused and done most of the work on the pipeline engineering. The facilities engineering has been very conceptual. But as I said, what Dave Haugen is doing in Long Beach right now is the kickoff meeting with Fluor Wurley to be able to advance that facility design. That design of that gas treatment facility is going to be in excess of $100 million. With the money that we received in the capital budget in FY13, we are now initiating that concept work to be able to advance it. And then if there's additional legislative funding in FY14, then we'll be able to open up the throttle, so to speak, and be able to advance the engineering both on the facilities and pipeline side to get to an open season with sufficient information to address concerns or answer questions that the shippers or producers may have.
Thank you.
What you see in front of you is the project schedule, the top schedule, which was the schedule that was given to us by the legislature. It was mandated by HB 369 in 2010 that we have project under construction in 2014 with gas and project startup at the end of 2015, early 2016. That was a very aggressive schedule, and unfortunately we have not achieved that. What you see in the bottom of the chart is our optimized plan. Again, we're in the front-end loading phase two, or FEL 2, portion of the project right now. With enabling legislation and sufficient funding, we'll be able to advance the engineering and regulatory work to get us through to an open season in late 2014, early 15, and then final or bridge engineering with that to project sanction at the end of 2015, with execution phase ordering pipe in 2016, ordering the modules for the gas conditioning facility, and then actually starting construction in 2017 with first gas in 2019-2020. So those are our milestones. Open season is, again, the first one where we actually would have the shippers and the producers looking at the project, looking to see if they are confident with the tariff models that we have come up with the cost estimates and the design for our facilities and pipeline, that they are willing to commit their money to be able to ship gas down this pipeline. That will lead then ultimately to a project sanction, which is the go-no-go decision to advance the project to seek the funding necessary and to begin the procurement of the long-term lead items and ultimately construction, leading to gas for Alaskans and Alaskan industry and economic opportunities in 2019 and 2020.
All right, Frank, for just for a follow-up here, you know, we're coming into, I don't know if I want to call it a renaissance, but, you know, with the explosion of shale gas in Lower 48, you see the steel manufacturing coming back to the United States, coming back from offshore, and I've been told that steel prices have dropped as much as 40% in the United States, and I think that's a good thing for us, and we're seeing the benefits of natural gas, and I just think there's a lot of positives with that.
Mr. Chairman, I was reading an article yesterday about Nucor, who 3 years ago had removed their steel plant, shipped it to Trinidad to be able to get closer to cheaper natural gas, and now they are building a new plant where they had removed that in Louisiana because they now have access to cheaper natural gas, so that we'll have, again, steel manufacturing in the United States at a lower cost. Now, Mr. Chairman, we get into the discussion on the tariff model. Darrell will chime in later when we get into the specifics, but we changed the tariff from what was the original concept where we were using the services at Black & Veatch. We have now created a tariff model on our own so that we as AGDC have the ability to make the alterations to the model and do it quite easily. We've changed the term for the tariff from original 20-year to a 30-year levelized term. As I said, we've advanced the project, so we've updated the cost estimates that we have. And with that, changed the contingencies that we had for the major components. The pipeline engineering, we originally had a 5% contingency, and I've increased that now to 10%. Just because of the level of engineering where we are, I wanted to make sure that we had sufficient room in that estimate so that we are, as we advance the project, we'll have better numbers. We've changed the debt equity split, the rate of return on the equity, and we've factored in the year delay from 2011 to 2012. And then we've also, again, using what is the Federal Reserve published rate out of Philadelphia of a 2.5% inflation, and then seeing how that affects the project tariff.
Anybody have any questions on that equity change? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Apologize, I had to step out. So what's the ownership model? Who's the owner of the pipeline? How do you envision that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have advanced this project. Initially, it was the concept of HB 369 to advance the project to get it to a point to hand it off to a private entity. In looking at the project, when looking at the benefits of partial state ownership or full state ownership, we've seen that with the backing of the state's bond rating, that we can actually bring in a cost of the project lower than it would be if it was all private equity money. So with that, the sponsors of HB 9 and now HB 4 are looking to provide the ownership model decision to AGDC in the future. We need to be able to work with partners and see if the benefit will be. to the state and to ultimately to the consumers on what is going to be the best model for ownership going forward. You'll see in our tariff comparison the impacts of state contribution to the project as well as the rate of return on equity to the project.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. And so a tariff, if the state were to assume ownership for the life of the project, what would the state be taking in, like a, I mean, I think testimony we've heard previous under a GEO is it was like a 14% rate of return is sort of normal. I mean, are you, is the state looking for like a competitive rate of return? Well, that was on a risky project. And what sort of rate of return is the state looking at over the life of the project?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm going to ask our commercial manager, Daryl Kleppen, to identify, the impacts of the rate of return and the debt equity split on the tariffs.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is Dan Fowsky, CEO, and then I'll turn it over to Daryl in a minute, but I'd like to, if I may, sir, go through you and respond to Senator Wilikowski and also a comment that Frank made.
Go ahead, sir.
I want to be careful that we don't, and Frank, I know when we mention the state bond rating, I want to be careful how we analyze that. This is going to be a project that's going to be issued on a revenue bond standpoint, and so the rating will be based on the credit of the project. Always when you operate within a state that has a high credit rating, and HFC experiences the same, that has an overall impact on the rating agencies as to how they view the economy within a state. But I don't want there to be a misunderstanding that this is going to be a project fully funded by and or backed by state credit. That is not how we have designed it. The credit rating will be established based on the precedent agreements and the long-term fixed contracts that are in place. The bonds that will be sold, that'll be the last thing that you end up doing. And it'll, all these contracts will be in place before you could ever get investors to come forward and invest in a project. The rate of return that Senator Wilikowski talks about, we have historically, we have kept it over the last couple of years at about 12% based on industry averages when you check these projects from Maine to Honolulu. We've subsequently lowered it by 1% to an 11% return on equity. If you look at that debt equity ratio, the advantage is to have more debt into it because you can sell debt cheaper than you can pay someone 11% for ownership, and so that then drives the tariff price down to a more equitable rate. But as you get into the open season and you start discussing with people and you start analyzing the ownership model, and I want to be very clear here, we've never once indicated that we would have the state operate it, but the state can certainly be an owner in such an endeavor. We've also recently had people ask of me on work I had done in the past on a mutual fund type basis when the state was looking at ways to raise money to raise a project because there's a great deal of interest by some. It's come up in committee hearings, if I may, that have asked for what would be the idea or the chances of Alaskans investing in a project like this. And so that's something that I had promised people, if called upon, we would do the research. And one more comment in closing, Frank had touched on, but the 2.5% inflation rate that we've established on this project is from the Philadelphia Reserve, which is a known entity, and it's a number that can be defended throughout. That's $200 million a year cost to this project. And if you discount those cash flows out 30 years, that's $1 billion cost in cash that it costs the residents or the citizens of this state on delaying on this project. And I'm not saying that to push on this. I'm just saying these multi-billion dollar projects, if determined and decided that they need to go forward, time is always of the essence, aside from the critical nature of this project and others that are being discussed because of what's going on in the Fairbanks area and rural areas of the state and others. So I'll end my comment there, but I wanted to make sure there was a clear understanding that this is not a credit based on issuance of debt by the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Dan.
I know there was a question, Mr. Chairman, of Daryl Kleppen. Would you like Daryl to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, was the question answered there? The rate of, in our new tariff model, Mr. Chair, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is Daryl Kleppen, AGGC commercial manager. In our tariff model, we assumed, as Dan indicated, a 75% debt to 25% equity. The rate of return on the 25% equity portion was 11%, versus in our original project plan in 2011, it was 12%, so it was down slightly. The cost of the debt was assumed to be the same, 5.7%, which is what we assumed in 2011. And current markets would suggest that you'd get a number lower than that, but we did not change it. We left it at 5.7%.
Follow up,
yeah.
Senator Bulikowski?
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is when you go, I mean, is the plan to go to the RCA and ask that they'll make, that there'll be a slight profit on this or some profit on this? Is someone looking to make money on this project, or is it just going to be totally cost neutral, pass everything on to the consumers, pass the savings on to the consumers?
Through the chair, Senator Bulikowski, the question is will people make money on the project? One of the provisions of HB 4 is for AGDC to have the authority to determine the ownership model. That has not been determined yet, if the state has any ownership share and what that percentage is. Very likely there will be other outside investors, and for those outside investors, their return on equity would be the 11% plus, you know, the cost of their debt, whatever that was. We've assumed 5.7. So within those numbers are returns for the bondholder and also for the people that provide the equity.
Thank you, Darrell. Frank?
Mr. Chairman, the comparison chart that you have in front of you right now identifies the impacts of the tariffs from the 2011 project plan to the 2012. The top line identifies the levelized term for Fairbanks at now $4.25 to $6, as opposed to the $6.45 in what was the enriched gas case. This reflects the elimination of the straddle plant primarily, but then also the elimination of the other facilities upstream. Big Lake or the Cook Inlet Basin, now the rates are from $5 to $7.25, as opposed to the $5.63. So we're providing a range just to identify that, again, at the level of the project engineering, we feel that we want to be able to indicate a low end and a high end. The lower portion of the chart identifies impacts of the cost drivers. The capital cost increase or decrease means a 50 to 80 cent reduction or increase on the cost of the tariff to the users in Fairbanks and Cook Inlet. The contribution by the state of Alaska by reducing the project cost would reduce the tariff by almost 45 cents. And then, as Darrell indicated, with the rate of return on equity, if it were to alter a percentage, it would impact it by plus or minus 20 cents per million BTU. And then the useful life of the bond, by shifting from a 20-year to a 30-year bond, we reduce the cost of the tariff, or could reduce the cost of the tariff by 75 cents. And then, as Dan identified, the overall cost of a year delay into the project schedule is 20 cents per million BTU. But as he indicated, over the life of the project, that equates to almost $1 billion extra that Alaskan consumers and businesses would have to pay. Mm-hmm. And again, the tariff is the cost to cover the construction of the pipeline project, as well as the operations in the out years.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bulikowski.
So that does not include the cost of the gas?
Through the chair, Senator Bulikowski, that is correct. That does not include the cost of the gas.
Do you have, if I could, Mr. Chair, so I'm just trying to, I think in Anchorage we're paying about $7, $7.50 for gas right now. Do you have sort of an all-in idea what we'd be paying in Anchorage if we were to start pumping this into our system?
Through the chair, Senator Bulikowski, the next slide, where I provide the cost of gas to consumers.
Great, thank you.
Getting right to the meat of the matter, looking at the optimized plan for Anchorage, the range would be $9 to $11.25 per million BTU. That includes a $2 cost for purchase of the gas on the North Slope and a $2 distribution cost, which is commensurate with what NSTAR is charging for their distribution system right now. That $9 to $11.25 is When I looked at the NSTAR website last week, they're projecting first quarter cost to consumer of approximately $9.30 overall cost at the burner tip.
So, Wilkowski.
And a couple questions. This is at the burner tip, and then are you assuming full capacity on the pipeline? And what if you had, say, half the capacity, 250 million cubic feet flowing through?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, these rates are based on a full flow on the pipeline. The impact of a reduced rate, I'm going to ask Mr. Kleppen to identify that. He's our model master.
Go ahead, Mr. Kleppen.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, as Frank indicated, the tariffs calculated are for a 500 million a day flow. For the 250 case, I don't have the tariff numbers in front of me. There is a sensitivity on the page around cost, but I don't have the numbers in front of me right now for 250. But fundamentally, if you have the same cost and your volume billable units go down by half, your cost would go up significantly. You could say if you haven't redesigned your pipeline for the smaller volume, you're still using 36-inch and running the lower rate, essentially your tariffs would almost double.
And just if someone could remind me, what's sort of the total amount of use, what's the total gas usage for, say, Anchorage and South Central and Fairbanks? I mean, I know you guys have that numbers. I've seen it before. How much gas are we using,
Chairman,
in Anchorage?
Yes, Dan, go ahead.
If I may, sir. Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, this is Dan Fowsky speaking. The total use is around, if you had Fairbanks maxed out at 60 million feet, which is what some of this is based on in essence, too, as the gas comes down, and about 180 million feet a day for Fairbanks, you're at about 240 million to 250 million feet a day for the rail belt down into the Kenai to the NSTAR system. When we held the expression of interest meeting a little over a year ago, when we solicited non-binding proposals in a confidential nature, we were able to, and we received responses back to maximize the use of the pipe at 500 million feet, which we were very pleased with. Again, as this progress or project advances, if you get into the open season is where the rubber hits the road on a deal like this, and you'd be able to determine the full usage of the pipe. One of the things I'd like to, maybe this will help all of you and to Senator Wilkowski, is we've always been operating under the mandate of House Bill 369, which was to provide gas to Alaskans at the lowest possible cost. And one of our guiding principles was always, if you can't beat the price of imported LNG, then this becomes a fool's errand. And so we watch this very carefully. And if we were to go to 250 million feet, then the analysis has to be, are we still at a point where we're able to beat the price of an imported product, whether it's coming from Russia or Canada and the various scenarios that I know you, you senators have been made aware of in your hearings. Then you'd have to take another look as we went through, as Frank has shown in the stage gate approach. As you advance this, one of the beauties of that approach is if all of a sudden all your numbers collapse or your deal goes apart, is you shut the project down and go in a different direction. So I guess what I'm trying to stress is the importance is if we're going to do this, you need to advance it now into these next levels to answer these various questions that keep coming, because until you get there, they're great discussions, but there's no hard data to back it up with, because you haven't had people come into a room and put pen to paper and tell you what it is they're willing to do and how much they're willing to pay for that.
Thank you for that overview, Dan.
Mr. Chairman, the slide that you have in front of you, the cost to Alaskans that the AGDC has identified from project concept has been up to $400 million to advance the project. That's to advance the project through an open season to a project sanction date in late 2015. We've currently been appropriated over the last several years $72 million and that's what we've used to advance and retain the project assets that we have acquired, the EIS, the engineering aspects. We are available, and we think that we can provide a long-term natural gas supply for Alaskans in the fairly near term, within the by the end of this decade. The cost is $7.7 billion based on our level of estimate right now. That is a mega project. A 36-inch pipe flowing 500 million cubic feet is a mega project. We can do this, we can achieve it, but it will take, again, the work by the legislature and work with the administration to be able to advance this project forward. As I identified previously, the cost to consumers in Anchorage now range from $9 to $11.25 per million BTUs, and in Fairbanks from $8.25 to $10 per million BTUs. Mr. Chairman, that's a very good cost of energy within the interior, where I think you're currently paying, for those on the LNG distribution system, approximately $23 per million BTU.
The numbers are very attractive, and I know people at home that are watching are saying the same thing.
If I may, Mr.
Senator Marchicki.
Yeah, I mean, considering the base price at Cook Inlet right now is $10, I would love to get $7 gas at my house, but that simply doesn't happen. The base price in Cook Inlet, you're competitive right now, and the question here, so our usage in Cook Inlet somewhere between 2 and 550, 550 being peak usage on a very cold winter day. We're simply not producing that, so that $10 base price, of course, is increasing as the gap continues to grow. I'm certainly interested in seeing it progress to understanding if these burner tip numbers are correct. And my question is this. We've been waiting for two generations for a natural gas pipeline from the slope. Previously, it was based on purely export. Now we're getting to where we have supply challenges in the Cook Inlet Basin as well, and the interior is starving for energy. If the producers don't move forward on a project, how do we push the schedule? What do you see as a decision point from the other project with the producers? And again, how do we shave some time off the delivery of a completed project?
Through the chair, Senator Marchicki. With any large project, with a major project, there's always the impetus to try and advance it as quickly as you can. But that's fraught with peril, and there have been numerous examples of trying to move a project forward that has ultimately led to major cost overruns. We're very serious in the charge that were provided to us to work this project through the stage gate approach to be able to advance a project if there is sufficient reason to advance the project. As Dan said, it'd be fool's errand if we are not able to provide a project with a cost to the consumer that would be less than LNG import. So we are, to this point, we've advanced the project with the funding that's been made available to us. We are, from the original project plan, the concept was to enter into that FEL 2 phase with a full funding scenario to be able to advance the engineering. It's very difficult to have an engineering company that's looking at designing a 770-mile pipe as well as almost a $2.35 billion gas conditioning facility on small increments of funding. To be able to do and advance the engineering for that major facility, we will need in excess of $100 million. We don't currently have that funding. The funding will be key to advance the project as we are able to then engage the engineers to be able to proceed on a rapid basis, but a diligent and I want to stress that the work will be done, but it has to be done so that we are not producing errors into the process.
Frank, I'd like to just follow up a little bit behind what you said. You know, you're an engineer and you've got a great team behind you, and I got smart people at the table here that know the business as well. But we heard a guy yesterday in Resources talk about the world has grown as far as assets and where people have to put their money with other projects around the world. I guess my point is, I go back to another year delay adds another $1 billion to the project. And my point being, these engineering firms, this isn't the only project they're going to look at. Engineering. We got 16 LNG export terminals, and that are looking to, you know, and pipeline projects going hither and yonder. And so we're not the only one in the queue here. So time is of the essence to a degree, provided we get all the bells and whistles and get the thing shook out right.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. With the explosion of the shale gas and shale oil in the lower 48, many of these engineering companies are working quite hard on other major projects. As you said, there are LNG export or turnarounds on what were import facilities that folks would like to be able to turn around and export the gas from the lower 48. All that takes major engineering. In our selection of an engineering company, one of the factors was having essentially an A team available to us, because we didn't want to work with a firm that didn't have the experience in the Arctic, that didn't have the large processing experience, and we wouldn't be able to then ultimately get a good design in a timely fashion. So that was one of the key aspects that we looked at. And so again, Mr. Haugen is there working with a joint venture between Fluor and Worley Parsons, world-class engineering companies that have done a considerable amount of work. They were there for TAPS. They've worked on the North Slope in the subsequent years, and it will be available for us to be able to advance it. They're initiating a project with the funding that we received in our fiscal year 13 effort. That was $21 million to be spread out across pipeline and facilities engineering. So this is the initiation of that project phased approach that will be looking for additional resources coming to us to be able to kick them off to the next in detailed design as the money becomes available.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to, you cited a $10 figure for NSTAR. I'm looking on their website, and it's didn't sound right to me. It's it's $0.72 per CCF. You convert that to MCF, it's $7.25. That's their tariff rate, 1-12, 1-2-13.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, it was a bar chart that showed the all-in cost.
Well, that's not a right number, according to NSTAR's website, because you add in the base rate, the GCA, the customer charge, and you're about $7.36.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, I apologize I didn't bring that chart with me, but I'll be glad to find it.
If you could, and then bring that to the committee, that'd be fine.
We'll do.
I have a question.
Senator Marchicki has a question.
So the project's... This is a concept that's interesting to me personally. I mean, normally you're looking at a project that has a return based on basic market and business principles. In this case, if there's a gap, a commercial gap, that is for the greater good of Alaskans that need energy, and we don't have a better option. Of course, I should just give the caveat that I'm assuming that all of the decisions are made with a very critical eye, making sure that we don't make the mistakes that are made on some larger projects. Is the group assuming, or I guess the way I'm saying it, is if there's a gap that delivers something different, delivers essential energy to Alaskans, I don't know that I wouldn't be willing to, as a legislator, to help support part of that gap. Is that sort of an assumption here, that if the open season does not adequately finance the project, that may be a discussion that the legislators have in this building as to whether or not the folks in this building would choose to fund that gap?
Through the Chair,
Chairman?
Yes, Dan, go ahead.
If I may, sir, and Frank, I apologize, but if I could just add something here. And to the Chair, to Senator Marchicci, I know that Frank went through a tariff comparison on some of the charts, and Senator Through our numerous travels around the state and I don't know how many seminars, or not seminars, but presentations we've given, there have been numerous requests or suggestions from citizens as to why can't the state just step up. And because of the nature of this project, do a contribution. We were not at liberty to do that as a matter of course, because that isn't what the law told us to do. But your point is very good, sir, in that this project was always intended to service Alaskans' gas, and if we could get a commercial outlay at the other end, that would be a wonderful moment. And back to what I'd said earlier about the fact that if you can beat the imported price of LNG, then you might have something that's worth pursuing. We feel we've done that. If you look back on one of the charts that Frank had, for every $1 billion the state contributed in capital, and we put this up on a chart because we kept getting asked, our estimate is that the tariff would drop about 45 cents. That's significant. We've had people suggest building a bigger pipe, for instance, a 48-inch line pipe, and we'd point out to people, well, the cost of that, just the incremental cost of that, just from Prudhoe to Fairbanks, I think it's $2.2 or $2.8 billion, and that's a cost that the RCA and others would not allow the consumers to bear because it would be significantly, especially if you're looking at 500 million feet of gas a day, we would have, you know, we'd simply be said, well, you folks really overbuilt it, and that's a cost that the state could bear. So there is an opportunity as we progress this. The only money that we've ever asked for and the only money that we've ever suggested would be a cost of the state was the $400 million that you've seen repeatedly, and that was to spend money that the state must spend to get this to an open season. It's not money that any company is going to spend. We're just simply not going to get companies that are going to spend that kind of capital to determine if Alaska is worthy of a project or not. And so the $400 million was a cost that the state would have to bear. We addressed that question yesterday. That wouldn't be regained through the tariff. We never factored that money into the tariff calculation. So it was a cost that the state would bear to advance this project. But I think, sir, you're going to get numerous discussions with your colleagues as to what happens if the state pursues this, and the more the money that gets put in, the answer then is that the more the tariff drops. The other, and I'll finish here just a moment with your indulgence, the other thing I've always liked about this project, when you look at Prudhoe, and there are other solutions out there or suggested solutions, but the beauty of Prudhoe is so massive that you've really solved this problem for the next 100 years. And that's not something a lot of the other projects can say. I'm not putting any fault on them or casting any dispersions, but it's a huge reservoir. And it'd probably be a beautiful thing if there was an announcement that there was a huge strike out in Cook Inlet. It would change the equation somewhat. But right now we don't have that. But we do have the beauty that we're drawing off one of the largest reserves in the world of gas. The problem we have is there's just not many of us. And that's one of the beauties that why we all love living here. But when you go and try and design projects and you're looking at a few hundred thousand people, this would be a whole different debate if you were trying to get gas to Los Angeles or Seattle. And I think all of us understand that. I'll stop here with just a comment made that there is room here. With cash infusion, the tariffs go down. And if it's determined as a public need, that would be something that you and your colleagues would certainly debate in your deliberations.
Thank you for that overview, Dan. I'd just like to remind the committee we're running up against the bewitching hour. If we could wrap up, some of us have to go to other committee hearings, and I'd like to stay on schedule. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, again, when we talked about funding, if we were able to receive the funding, full funding allocation, we'll advance the engineering for both pipeline and facilities. We'll conduct the permitting activities and the agency involvement to meet the requirements, both state and federal permits, and we'll advance our engineering field investigations to be able to identify how we will need to alter our designs based on what we find in the field. If we're partially funded, again, limited engineering, both on pipeline facilities and limited field investigation. And then we get to enabling legislation. We've identified that one of the impediments that we've had is the inability to have confidential discussions or receive confidential information. So that means that we are somewhat behind the curve in regards to advancing the project with meaningful discussions with shippers and or with other pipeline projects that may have or are receiving state funds and doing similar work. We do not want to spend our money unnecessarily. And if there is work that can be shared between the projects, we would love to be able to do that. However, the projects that I'm talking about are unwilling to without our ability to hold that information confidential. We talk about contract carrier status needed to enter into long-term contracts. This is the ability for utilities to know if they commit to purchasing gas that they are going to be delivered that gas, and that if another entrant comes into the pipeline, that they won't see a reduction in what they were intending to have delivered to them. And then we're looking at, again, the authority to determine an ownership model that will allow the state of Alaska to benefit not only from providing energy to Alaskans, but also providing to Alaskans at the lowest possible cost. And that legislation, again, the sponsors with Speaker Chenault and Representative Hawker are advancing now HB 4. We had our first hearing in House Resources yesterday, and we'll continue those hearings to be able to talk through the model that the sponsors have provided to us. And with that, Mr. Chairman, concludes the prepared remarks, and we're, again, available to answer any questions that you may have for us.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Richards, could you elaborate a bit more about why you chose the contract versus common carrier? I've heard it said that originally you were asked to create a common carrier pipeline.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'm again going to defer to our commercial manager, Darrell Kleppen.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. First of all, historically, most gas pipelines are contract carriers versus common carriers. And, for example, the APP pipeline and the Denali pipeline were designed as contract carriers. And there's a reason why gas is treated differently than oil, because fundamentally the underlying value of the gas is pretty much equivalent to the cost of transporting it, and that's different than oil. And the users for the service are different. For example, a utility wants a long-term guaranteed supply, and they want a contract that covers that. And that is kind of how contract carriage grew up, and that is consistent with other gas pipelines. The issue we have with a contract carrier, when you contract for the service, you have that space available, and whether you supply the gas or not, you have to pay the tariff. And oftentimes, gas pipelines are referred to take or pay. Oil pipelines are different in that if someone brings oil into taps next month, it's transported. And if the capacity, because of pumps or whatever, is not available, then everyone is prorated and everyone loses volume on a pro rata share. Obviously, utilities that are dependent upon the product cannot function that way. So this is kind of a short reason why gas pipelines are contract carriers, as is the ASAP pipeline.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. Dan, go ahead.
If I may, just add to through the chair to Senator Giesel, this is Dan Fowsky. When you get back to the financing model as well on the contract carriage, as I talked earlier about a $7.5 billion project and how you would finance it, there need to be long-term contracts in place so that an investor is going to know that the cash flows being generated support or have the ability to support the debt service on the revenue bonds that would be issued. Again, a little bit different scenario, as Darrell had pointed out, as to common carrier versus contract carrier. I also like to remind people that when we when we're designing this, if you're looking at 500 million feet of gas a day, you certainly want the ability to expand going out into the future. But I think we get confused then with, well, how many explorers are going to be out there looking to get involved in a 500 million feet of gas a day? We're seeing that we're having difficulty, or at least so far, on a $3.5 to $4 billion pipeline, holding a successful open season for the same issue. So remains to be seen, comparing the big versus the small, how it goes forward. But if you get back to the financing, this creates a real problem in terms of the ability to show going out a number of years, 10, 15, 20 years, as to how this would be paid. If we wanted to expand it, you can add compression and you can do looping, and there are other mechanisms that can be used to enhance the project and increase the volume.
Thank you, Dan. Any other questions from members? If not, I'd like to thank Frank, Dan, and Daryl for a very informative presentation. Probably this won't be your first and only time here. I'm sure you'll be back. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 12th, 7:30 a.m. with Bill Walker from the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority. He'll be giving an overview of Alaska's gas pipeline from the Port Authority's view. Thank you. I would like to adjourn the meeting at 8:37.